Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
So I saw everyone's favorite Broadway twink last night.
Well, that could be one of many people.
Yeah, but I bet you could make a list of like six.
Yeah. I would just name all my favorites. Okay. Anyway, who are you talking about?
I want you to guess.
Was it AKB?
It was not AKB.
Would you count him as a twink? That's the question.
I think if we're in like roles, if there's like a category of roles that AKB would be considered for, this person is also in that category. Thus,
okay, interesting.
Broadway twink.
I mean, my favorite is Barrett Foa, but I know he isn't.
No,
your favorite.
not Barrett Foa.
Hunter Parrish? He's not Broadway.
Not Hunter Parrish. Has a tangential connection to our current show through the director.
Oh, Andy Mientes?
Andy Mientes. He is starring in The Who's Tommy in Denver right now.
Oh, yes. You told me that.
It was awesome.
Was it really good?
It was really good. Double turntables are so in right now.
Of course they are.
All it takes
is all
Hamilton.
The things that we can do.
Will somebody get us another drink?
Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theatre Happy Hour, your weekly podcast with heels and hangovers.
Do you like that one?
The script, Thomas.
I wrote that one. That never happened.
You did. That literally never. I think this is the first, and it's a great one. I like both heels. I don't like hangovers, but can relate.
I will say the two do not go well together.
No. Again, can relate. Production of Rent, all I'm saying. So hey, TT.
Yeah.
What you drinking?
I got in front of me a mango IPA. Stole the one drink from you in the whole show, not even a drink.
I had a backup.
Because you're a planner.
Yep, I am. I do think about these things. Well, I'm drinking some milk straight from the goat.
Ew.
It's tasty. Don't knock it until you've tried it, mate.
This is a weird question. Have you ever seen a goat in real life?
What? Yeah.
Okay.
Have you never seen a goat?
No, I have. But like so in what context have you seen a goat?
Like so many things, like petting zoos mostly.
Okay.
But then I feel like farms.
Okay. How often do you go to a farm?
Well, we're British.
Where do you have farms? I'm from the Midwest. We're made of farms.
Yeah, but we've got like country farms. I don't know. I feel like I've been to lots of farms. Blair Drummond Safari Park. This is something that only Scots will understand.
No,
has the best petting zoo I've
When they make a poster about our podcast and they quote us, I want your quote to be, I feel like I've been to a lot of farms.
I don't think, is that a strange, do you not go to farms often?
I've been to farms, I've seen goats, I've been to farms.
I've seen, that'll be your,
how dare you?
That'll be your quote. I've seen goats. Genuine question. Do you go to pumpkin patches?
Yeah, absolutely.
And like Halloween, like that is my one of my favorite American things.
Oh, is that? Oh, I guess. Do you have?
Yeah,
Can you grow pumpkins in that climate? Probably not.
I don't know. Probably. Well, I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah. We're maybe a bit too wet. I don't know what they like. Yeah. But we certainly don't have... They're just so cool.
Yeah.
Oh, what a lovely thing.
Have you ever been in a corn maze?
No, this is it. You get corn mazes every year.
It's so much fun. It's not really that fun,
maze.
Like, as a just a pure experience, but the whole surrounding experience is fun. I find
is
a corn maze
really,
kind of...
like, scary?
No.
Do you not feel like you're in Signs?
No.
Remember Signs?
You're just surrounded by a bunch of tourists... with a bunch of going stale corn around you.
Okay.
I grew
in the illusion for me.
I grew up in the Midwest. We have nothing but corn and soybeans for miles.
Excellent. And goats, apparently. So,
yeah.
Here we go.
Speaking
have seen goats.
You've
have
seen
not
goats?
Drunk from a goat's teat.
Have you had goat cheese?
Just for the record. Oh, love it. One of my favorites. Make some really good meals with goat's cheese.
Excellent. And next on my goat-themed questions. No. But speaking of livestock.
Yes. Well.
I have last week's quiz question, which if you don't know the answer, is a strange transition.
Exactly. It's kind of rude.
Last week's question, we asked, what show stars quote-unquote actors named Effie, Dina, and Laurel, but has nothing to do with Dreamgirls?
And some people got it.
Yeah, good for them.
I thought this was one of our hardest to date.
I think it's absolutely difficult. What show was it, Jimmy?
It is Once on This Island. Yeah. Asaka.
Temperamental gods rule our island. Asaka, mother of the earth.
Akwe, god of water.
Ezuli, beautiful goddess of love.
Hey, Papage, sly demon of death.
Asaka, grow me a garden.
Please, Akwe, don't flood my garden.
Ezuli, who will my love be?
Papage, don't come around me.
Explain this quiz question right away.
Absolutely. Straight off the mark.
They're the chickens in the show are named after the Dream Girls.
They are the names of the chickens. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's also a couple of goats in the current Broadway revival.
There are. There's some bell peppers that get cooked live on stage. We'll talk about that in a minute.
So, Once on This Island by the great Stephen Flaherty and Lynn Ahrens.
Yes, indeed. Our first Irons and Flaherty.
Is that true?
Yeah, welcome.
How have we gone that so far?
Well,
they've got a lot of great stuff.
They do, actually. They do. Yeah, I don't know.
Do you know how they met? They met working on Schoolhouse Rock together.
Yeah.
Of all things.
Nice. I think they've got a beautiful story. In fact, straight off the mark, there is a great academic text about their history, which I'll put straight in the show notes because it's actually a really good read. It's very interesting. A lovely pair.
Yeah, a stalwart of, I think, like contemporary musical theater, not in style, but in time period.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the greatest.
Absolutely. Super popular high school shows of all things, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Well, interestingly, for you, but not really for us.
Really? All right.
Yeah.
Once on This Island is based on a novel.
Yep.
It's called My Love, My Love, or The Peasant Girl by Rosa Guy.
It debuted on Broadway in 1990, and then opened on the West End in 1995.
It's currently
quite successful.
Yeah, it's currently on Broadway at Circle in the Square. It's up for Best Revival at this year's Tonys.
It is indeed.
It won no Tonys in its opening run.
No, none whatsoever. It did. It won the Olivier for Best Musical, but that was it.
Yeah.
So
now it's got its chance this year. Best Revival.
It really does. Maybe chat a bit later, get it on the t-shirt, about its prospects.
Yeah.
But yeah, talk to me about Once on This Island. T, what is it?
Oh, Once on This Island is a great show. Once on This Island is at its core, it's a cross between The Little Mermaid and Romeo and Juliet, which then was reflected in the novel My Love, My Love. It's set in the French Antilles, on some Haitian island, and is a story. It is a story within a story. They're telling the story to you as it happens, about two different worlds never meant to meet, that live on this island. The dark-skinned natives of the island and the mixed race, richer, upper class of the island, and
the condoms.
Exactly, and how Timon, one girl from darker skinned people there, goes on a journey that the gods of the island send her on.
Yeah,
that seemed fair.
That was beautifully summarized.
Thank you.
Well done, ye. Well, after that gorgeous summary, let's just. I feel like that's a strange place to dive straight into.
We're going deep right away.
I know, it's going to happen. But that's fine. There's lots to talk about with this show.
Yeah.
So, Bazinga, let's do it.
Look down, hear my prayer. Don't single me out and then forget me. Oh, God, let me fly. Set me to places where no one before me has been. You spared my life. Show me why. You get me to rise like a fish to the bait. Then tell me to wait. Well, I'm waiting for life to begin. Waiting for life once more to begin.
Did you start our transition with Bazinga?
I did. I don't even watch it. I've never even seen an episode. Genuinely, I've just seen it on a t-shirt and I thought, that's entertaining.
I don't know if we can be friends anymore.
Why, do you like it?
No, I hate it.
All right. Well, I just said I didn't watch it.
Big Bang Theory is everything that's wrong with the world.
I think that I've heard a lot of people say that. So there you go. Anyway.
Let's talk about race, Jimmy.
Let's talk. We love it.
Oh, man.
I mean, I guess, like, the thing is, one of the unavoidable things with this show is talking about race. It's a huge part
of the show. And I think exactly. comes with the standard disclaimer. You, Jimmy, and I are both very white, and we are about to attempt to talk scholarly about experiences that we do not have. And, like, I think we attempt to do so with sensitivity at all times, but we'll invariably mess something up.
But, yeah, always learning.
Always, yeah.
Always learning. I think one of the kind of key things to start with is Once on This Island kind of represents a community that doesn't have any other representation in popular musical theatre.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty fair.
Off the top of my head, I couldn't give you another.
Wait, at least in a, you know, there are certainly, we've talked about The Wiz, we've talked about black representation in musical theater in a couple different areas before. I do think very specifically, so this musical, despite being a fictional tale, is very corely based on the Haitian Revolution. the Haitian Revolution was in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And they tell you this history in the musical. It's the sad tale of the Beaux-Hommes. Pardon my French. The French conquered, colonized these islands in the Caribbean, enslaved basically a lot of the native African dark-skinned people there. And then the slaves revolted and kicked the French out. And it is to date the only sovereign nation that can declare its sovereignty stemmed from a slave revolution.
Yeah. It was one of the kind of earliest like changes.
Yeah.
Certainly, I mean, in the US.
Yeah, absolutely.
1804, I think. It's something about that.
No, that's pretty close. 1804, 1st of January, 1804.
There you go.
And
crazy.
So they kicked the French out. But this, I don't know, like kind of bizarre social construct seemed to precipitate out of the Haitian Revolution. The island kind of delineated itself into two different populations. One population being the darker skinned natives, and one population being the descendants of the children of the French and the native people, with their skin the color of coffee mixed with cream. The less politically correct term, which I say now because there's a quote I want to pull later, is mulatto. I think mixed might be more appropriate nowadays.
Yeah.
But this kind of two-class, two-caste system developed in the place. And it's an interesting sociological study because they came from a system where there were two classes, right? The white people and the black people.
Yeah.
Expelled the white people and then happened to kind of regress into this two-class system again for whatever reason.
Absolutely.
And that really informs a lot of the show.
Yeah, and I think scholars better than us could tell us, I'm sure, why that happened.
Yeah.
But I don't doubt that an element of it is that sense of, when you remove the top, something has to go in its place.
Yeah.
You know? And so there would no doubt be some kind of delineation there. But in terms of sort of going right back to it, like what I meant about in terms of representation of this community, I do mean the sort of Haitian voodoo culture.
Yeah,
basically,
absolutely.
There's nothing like that, and it does have a very distinct place in American history. In terms of how it's influenced, because the first time I was ever introduced to it was, have you ever read American Gods?
I am acquainted with it, but have not read it.
Yeah. Kind of spoiler alert, if you've not read American Gods, basically it tells many different stories, but one of the key features of it is these sections called Coming to America, where it talks about how, obviously, America is a smorgasbord of cultures, religions.
Yeah.
And it's about how people brought their religion to America in various different guises.
Yeah.
One of the bigger ones being, obviously, coming from the African slave trade. And it talks, not hugely, but in a little way, it talks about kind of the origins of voodoo in the US.
Yeah.
And it's still prevalent today. There's, there are still, in some of the southern states, there are still... people who practice this.
Absolutely. Around New Orleans and Louisiana, their whole populations. And I will say additionally, I think it is a... I think a lot of times in pieces of literature that come out of Western culture, there is, this is not a word, but an exoticization of other cultures, if you will. that like, oh, how interesting this foreign ideal, you know? Oh, yeah. look at the different people. Aren't they interesting and quaint? This musical doesn't do that. It doesn't minimize this kind of Haitian voodoo culture, where I would say things like, absolutely, The King and I does.
Yes.
But yeah, even, absolutely. Even contemporarily, I would argue something like The Book of Mormon does about... you know, some forms of African culture. Part of it
and
is
Mormonism.
And part of it is because it's a satire and it's supposed to be elevated and you're supposed to laugh at it, and that's the whole, you know, Matt Parker, Trey Stone idea is like, am I allowed to laugh at this? Is it supposed to be funny?
Yeah.
But like Salt Lake City, the fact that we're laughing at like your misunderstanding, or the whole when they reenact the story of the prophet Joseph Smith and like, oh, how silly that the natives got this wrong, and you're laughing at them. Island has none of this. And I think that is a like sleeper cell revolutionary bit to this piece of Western literature, fully Western literature.
Yeah, definitely. It feels like a really nice children's book.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's a very simplified, very condensed version of what is an extremely intricate culture.
Right.
And it's just a nice, easy way for people who might have no idea about it to learn something.
Yeah. And it's, I would say it is so, it's so subtle that like, nothing against my mother, but my Irish Catholic mother could go and see this and not, and not entirely feel ostracized by it and not feel like she's, you know, thrown into this obscure culture world. It's inviting, it's welcoming, and it's not minimizing.
No, not at all. And I'd say it's right there in the actual story of the show that it's about telling stories and sharing with other people.
Right.
One of the last lines is go forth and, you know, tell this story. So I think that's so key to it. And you can tell that when Aarons and Flaherty were writing it, that is a huge part of it, is that it was supposed to be a bit of an education, I guess.
Yeah. So
and a celebration. So.
This is a question I have, and clearly we are not the ones to decide this, but I'm going to ask you this question, Jimmy. Aarons and Flaherty are both decidedly white.
Yeah, they really are.
They wrote this show about a black population, about a black culture.
Yep.
Is that okay?
Well, so here's the thing. We've talked about this before.
Right, of course.
I think Scots for Boys was the time I said it most eloquently. So feel free to go back and listen to that, because I'm mildly sleep deprived.
Cut that clip back in.
just paste it back in. I think it's by no means the most ideal situation. And in many ways, it's not something that should be happening. What I will say, there's almost a sense of, if not them, then who? Now, I realize that was a sweeping statement. I'm not saying that there are not black composers out there. Obviously, there are.
Of course.
We know there's a race problem that is... what's that word? Insidious.
Yes.
In our lovely world of musical theater, and especially back in the 90s, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Strides weren't being made then. Not at all. So it's much easier for white duo Aarons and Flaherty to get a show onto Broadway than it would be for a black composer.
Right.
It's that disgusting truth.
Yeah.
Of the matter. And so you do kind of get this question of, well, is it better to have something than nothing?
Yeah.
And I would say when the content's good,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you put it well. I agree. But it's a discussion I've seen pop up in other places. And I do find fascinating. And like, also, the question, is it okay for them to do this, is a non-starter. Because you know what? They did.
Exactly. They did. And... It's very successful, you know, and you just have to look to how black audiences feel about this show. And as far as certainly from what I've been reading, there is an overwhelmingly positive response to it.
Yeah.
Which is great. You know, if you take something like, for example, Miss Saigon.
Right.
They had a very tricky start. They made some big mistakes.
Yeah.
And that kind of propagated a much more fraught racism debate.
Yeah.
Around that show.
Yeah.
And that there are a lot of Asian communities who really disapprove of it and disapprove of what it says. There are still Asian communities who are very for it.
Yeah.
But for something like Once in This Island, I feel like it's just an overwhelming sense of yes.
Yeah. There's so much positivity. I mean, I don't know if you've come across any in your research, but in all of my research about this show, I have not been able to find a single instance of any group raising protest about this show.
There was one article that I don't agree with. We'll talk about it when we get into talking a bit about themes. But it did kind of try and play the race card, but I don't really know. I feel like it was just clickbait.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? I can't see where their argument
comes from. I am interested to hear because, you know, as our disclaimer goes, this is not our experience. And so I do I do wonder, you know, what am I missing? But so this perhaps leads into an issue that I hold near and dear to my soul and my heart on like a questioning level. Once on This Island is a hugely popular high school show in the United States. Like on those yearly lists they do of the top 50 shows, it is always in the top 10 without fail.
Wow.
It's got a huge cast, simple songs. It's a storytelling piece, so you can do it in a gym wearing colorful t-shirts. Like it is built at its core in 95% of its ways as a high school show.
Yeah.
But with a capital B, or maybe even in all caps, underlined and in italics, it is a show written to be performed entirely by Black people.
Yeah.
And most schools that have theater programs in America don't have Black populations. I have seen this change and improve over my now maybe 7 professional years in educational theater. You know, put bluntly, there are more Black kids doing theater for whatever reason.
Yep.
But going into it, when I was studying in college, like looking at high school programs across the nation, they're not a lot, either in schools that are predominantly Black or in schools that served mixed populations, the white kids do the theater.
Exactly.
You know, it speaks to the systemic issues. It speaks to all these things. But so then how do all these schools do Once on This Island? And I have, and this is a long quote here, but it's the author's note at the beginning of the MTI published script for Once on This Island.
Mm-hmm.
It's like on page 5. And it says, regarding casting amateur productions, Once on This Island is based on the cultural, religious, and racial divisions found in Haiti between the mulatto ruling class and the dark-skinned rural peasants. Our original production in New York was strictly cast along these racial lines, and the text makes references in several places to skin color. We think the power of the story has a great deal to do with the issue of prejudice within the race, as well as with issues of wealth and class. We strongly hope that the casting of future companies will reflect our intent as far as possible. However, we understand the potential casting difficulties which may arise for some amateur theater groups, as well as their desire, in some cases, to present interracial productions. To this end, we've supplied certain specific text alterations which might allow a greater flexibility in making casting choices, while still maintaining the core ideas of prejudice and the separation of people because of their differences. Mm-hmm. Our best wishes for a successful, joyous production, Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty.
Yep. It's such a tricky one.
I don't know how I feel about this, Jimmy. And before I knew that this author note existed, I didn't know how I feel about this. When I first listened to the cast album, I didn't know how I felt about this. When I became a theater teacher, I didn't know how I feel about this. And like every year when we go through play selection, I don't know how I feel about this.
Absolutely. It's something we talk about a lot over here because while... you know, race and getting non-white people to be involved in theater is tricky for you guys.
Yeah.
Even trickier for us.
Oh, I'm sure.
Particularly in Scotland.
Right.
Where the, you know, the population demographics are completely different.
Yeah, it's a numbers game.
Absolutely. So there are just shows that you don't even consider because it's just not going to happen. And you always get this debate of people being like, yeah, but... And like, yeah, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
And I think Uti is one of these shows that it doesn't work. Like it's there in the language of what Irons and Flaherty are saying here.
Yeah.
And they say that in some cases to present interracial productions.
Yeah.
That is interracial. That is not
right.
All white productions.
Right. Which I think the thing is I have seen all white productions.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same with Hairspray.
Yeah.
Hairspray is probably one of the biggest ones that we have over here mm-hmm. that treads the line. And there is another, I can't remember what it is, but there is another author's note in the Hairspray script mm-hmm. That kind of it doesn't excuse it, but it sort of says, yeah, you can do this. And it never works.
No.
It never works.
Yeah.
There's no point.
The thing I do think is, because like, so in my mind, I draw a hard line with Hairspray. I draw a hard line with Ragtime.
Yeah.
I probably even draw a hard line with The Wiz.
Yeah.
The line is softer with Once on This Island.
Right, interesting.
And part of it is because of this author's note. And they do, the changes they'd list, there's a whole page. It's just one page, but it's 8 changes.
Yeah.
In the whole show, which I think, whereas like if you do Hairspray with a, you know, less than black cast, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're not making script changes to accommodate that.
No.
Right? So they, you know, Aarons and Flaherty have gone out of their way to make this more on the okay side.
Mm-hmm.
But it then immediately undermines so much of the core of the show.
Absolutely. It's just in the sense that it's not in our culture.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? We can't sing from any sense of authenticity because...
Right.
We don't know.
Because it's
entirely
inauthentic, yeah.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, obviously you're going to be like, it's a fucking high school.
Right.
What does it matter? But it's just, I don't know, it's just...
But like, that's where it starts.
Our
but
story
then,
to tell, yeah. But,
so then here's where my high school brain goes on the other side of it. What a I might have mentioned this. One of the best productions of Fiddler on the Roof I ever saw was performed by a Catholic school.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Because you have to step outside of your own cultural boundaries and literally empathize with the other because mm-hmm. the person you're playing is the other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Catholic and Jewish differences aside, I see huge educational potential in bringing this show to, you know, a Midwestern or Coloradan white student group as a study piece, right? As a like, let's talk about a culture that's not yours in a really deep way.
Mm-hmm.
But where does it cross that line?
I guess I would just be like, I wouldn't trust high school directors, no offense to you.
No, absolutely.
I wouldn't trust high school directors like, let's use this as a learning experience. Okay, right. Let's go in and we're going to study Haitian culture.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of I don't know if you've been on YouTube recently, but like, I saw a video of this show where Papa Gay was in like a bowler hat and like
yeah.
like a gangster from Guys and Dolls. And
right.
Like, we're not doing this right.
We're not in Haiti anymore.
Yeah, there's you know some there's some accidental erasure going on here.
Yeah. It's total erasure. I mean they won't be singing it in authentic accent. They won't be singing it playing the music with authentic instrumentation, you know what
right.
I mean, it's losing all of its authenticity by the second, and it just becomes a story set on a beach.
Right.
Like, it,
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, just do Little Mermaid and be done with it.
Exactly. It's one of those things as well. There are plenty of shows.
Yeah,
there are plenty
true.
Of shows out there. It's endlessly tricky.
Yeah, it's
endlessly.
Man, I was hoping I was going to be able to land on an answer.
No, it's one of those ones, like, I know it's kind of in your gray line.
Yeah.
It's not in mine. It's firmly.
Yeah.
I can't get by it. I don't know. Maybe just because it's not something that we would really ever do. I have known productions of it to happen. They've been very good. But it's just not. It's not right.
Yeah.
It's not right.
It's hard. Oh.
Yeah. I can't. Do you know what? I can't think of any. Can I think of any like predominantly race-driven show that I'm like, yeah, do you know what, that one wouldn't be as bad. Do you know what I mean? I'm thinking of The Scots for Boys, I'm thinking of Parade, or you know, like you say, The Wiz. I'm looking at the wall again.
Hair.
You know what I mean, you just,
if you have a bunch of white girls singing White Boys Are So Pretty, it doesn't really have its impact anymore, does it?
No, don't even. Don't even.
Yeah.
There's no, just too, you know, I mean, it's just too much. Yeah. So
well, so this, I saw the Who's Tommy yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen it performed?
Not performed. I've seen the recorded version.
Okay,
but I've never seen it live.
So Tommy grows up throughout the show, and three actors play him. Right, there's a young child version, a medium child version, and then the adult. This production first made the choice that Tommy's parents, were both. Oh, I actually don't remember. the young kid was a tiny little white boy. The medium kid was a medium sized little black boy, and then the adult guy was Andy Mientis.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And the idea is that they're all the same person, and that they grow up through it, and like, clearly. You know, we are making some anti-statements through this, because Tommy's not a show about race.
No, not at all.
In any explicit way. And so instead we're making a statement about theatricality, about like, it don't matter what you look like, you can play this role. And it was you know, I went to a 6:30 Tuesday performance of this. Me and my boyfriend weren't the youngest people there, but we were probably 35 years younger than the average age of the entire audience.
Yeah.
And when tiny Tommy turned into medium Tommy and went from being a tiny white boy into a medium black boy, there were murmurs in the audience. And it had nothing to do, like, the transition was very clear. He was in the same costume. It was very well staged. And I don't think the theater-going audience who signed up to go see The Who's Tommy in Central Denver is particularly, you know, latently racist.
Right.
Like, I really don't feel that. But still, there's this murmuring going on. Like, I love that all of this fascinating in a theatrical context, you know?
I love that in a show, like, The Who's Tommy. Right. Like, well, that's not believable.
Right.
Like, come on, it's The Who's Tommy.
And then Tommy's dad takes him to, like, a drug den to cure him of his deaf, dumb, and blindness. Like,
exactly.
Yeah. But that's the thing. But so, like, those people who murmur over that wouldn't bat an eye going to see their white grandchildren's production of Once on This Island.
Not at all. They'd love it.
But I find, like, my reaction is entirely opposite, you know? Mm-hmm. Once on This Island, I'm like, no, why'd you do that? But in Tommy, I'm like, ah, great, great choice.
Yeah.
It's paradoxical in my brain. I don't understand.
I know. Yep.
I guess
never will.
Yeah, I'll never understand.
Managed to endure. those you learned it from.
You are part. So, Jimmy, I think we should move to perhaps a less difficult and complex issue like race. Race.
race!
Race. To, you know,
race.
A simpler topic like gender. Yes.
Good old gender. Hey, we've not really talked much about gender.
It's been a while. I guess
Hedvig?
Yeah, maybe. Certainly we've maybe talked about gender identity and certainly sexual orientation, and these all fall under a giant vague umbrella. Ooh, I want to make a vague umbrella. It like stops some of the rain.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe.
I didn't expect, if you asked me, like if we did the show last year before the Broadway revival, I don't think I would have thought of gender as like a big topic about it.
No, not at all. Not at all. Because I've listened to this for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And it's always felt like a little fairy tale.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it is about this recent production which has changed my whole view. Mm-hmm. And the cast recording as well, just it's like changed my whole view on the show.
And they've like made some specific choices centered around gender and gender identity that like have then made me question other script choices that exist outside of that that are gender in this show, you know?
Yep.
So,
we're beating around the bush. Let's
we are. Specifically, this new Broadway revival bends two of the god roles, right? Mm-hmm. Alex Newell plays Asaka, traditionally a female role.
Yep.
Alex Newell uses male pronouns but is gender fluid. And Merle Dandridge plays Papagay, traditionally a male role. Merle is decidedly female.
Yeah.
And it's interesting.
Totally. But also kind of just makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they're gods.
Yeah. They can be.
Who are we to question? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it is. It's really interesting. So the way that kind of Haitian voodoo gods work, or certainly from what I've studied in the past week, are that they are very characterful beings and have a lot of personality.
Yeah.
And they do have distinct genders, but there's so many of them, and within each kind of grouping, there's so, you know, it doesn't really matter if they're male or female.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? That doesn't really affect what they do. They're just, exactly.
Yeah.
They'll still do the same things. So to me, it kind of dramaturgically, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And the thing is if you have someone like Alex Newell that exists in your world, use Alex Newell because he's the best.
And the interesting thing is the dual choice. We use this term in high school theater a lot about a breeches role where you cast a girl as a guy in breeches.
Right. Yeah.
And the decision is that this character remains male in identity.
Yeah.
And it is just a female playing a male, but we're not trying to make, like, you put their hair up under a hat. You're not trying to make any commentary about this.
It's Peter Pan.
It's Peter Pan. Yeah. And whatever the probably poorly termed breeches role name is for a female role, that is the Alex Newell as Asaka choice, right?
Yeah.
It's entirely in drag, so much so that it seems a poor choice to call it drag. You know,
exactly.
It's just simply female, not even presenting as female, but like just purely feminine. But then Merle as Papagay is also decidedly female in presentation in this role that before was a male role. And to have them both at the same time is, you know, it explodes the gender discussion for the show.
Oh, so much. And I think it all comes down to Merle Dandridge and that decision, because that is the thing that makes it, it feels like a female-led story now.
Yes.
And that women are at the heart of it.
Yeah.
Agwe's there, But he don't really do much.
I always feel bad for him. And like in the high school productions, he's always the kid who like you need to give a lead to, but you don't really want to. Their songs are early on, so like you can get Agwe's song out of the way, and then Agwe doesn't really do a lot after
it's such
Rain.
A good song.
Oh, it's
That's
a great song,
thing.
And
it's
you can have your, you can put your poor singer in it. But
well, hey, this just so I can put it in the show notes. Mitch Grassi, you know Mitch Grassi from weirdly enough. Can you see what?
No, I can't.
Pentatonics.
Okay.
He played Agwe in a high school production, and there's video footage of that. I'll put that in the show notes.
That's amazing.
He was extremely good. I think he's one of the best singers on the planet.
I'm
He could easily be in Osaka.
Yeah, I'm excited to watch that. But yeah. I think you're absolutely right that Papagei as a female presenting role, especially with how much Papagei interfaces with Timon. Over the idea of will you sacrifice yourself for this man?
Yep.
Absolutely modifies the narrative of this show.
Whoa, so much. So much. And you know what? I mean, if you think about it in terms of how they're telling the story to this young girl.
Right.
You know, I mean, it becomes, instead of just like fun fairy tale, it becomes like warning story you know, it's, you almost imagine that it's like a story that mothers pass down to their daughters to help them become stronger women.
I mean, so let's talk about Timon as a feminist icon briefly, because in the pure, if you're reading this musical as a book, I think Timon is a strong character for sure, but doesn't have a lot to say as far as her efficacy is like a strong independent woman in the love story of this show.
Well, see, this is it. This is it. I can't tell if I agree or not because there's, I go back and forth so much. You go first.
Okay.
And then I'll try and
so it. On its surface, Timon falls in love with a man who she meets when he can't speak, when he's basically dead. She's very much in love with the idea of him, a stranger in white in a car, but has no reason to fall in love with him. They have their one, you know, oh God, it's my least favorite song in the show.
Forever Mine.
No.
Forever Yours.
No. The one, we'll race away in a car. See, you don't know it because you skip it on the CD.
Is it? No, I don't. Is it the Daniel one?
Yeah, the Daniel one. And Papagei swings in, is like, mine! And then it gets much better. But like, that song, that's the only time they have to actually fall in love on a legitimate level. And it is just barely surface level. She's in love with the idea of, you know, it's Ariel falling in love with the land. Not falling in love with Prince Eric. I want to be away from this place. I'm infatuated with the idea of humans with, oh, you know, what do you call them? Feet. Like, I'm infatuated with the people on the other side of the gates, on the other side of the wall. Which, like, this is a, I think, a negative female trope that has existed forever. You're in love with the idea of this category of man, and you pick the first one that crashes in a car on your doorstep.
Yeah.
Right? And that follows through the show. And in the writing of the show, with Papagei as a male figure coming into Timon, it's like, will you sacrifice your life for this man? Kind of forwards that. But then when you flip Papagei on its head and turn it into a female presenting role, it adds so much more strength to that. It de-genderifies it. Makes it more about the concept of love. It lets me forgive the quick love story a little more as just a storytelling device. We only have so much time to fall in love over, you know, our 95 minute musical or whatever. And then especially when Papagei comes back the second time, you know, trade your soul back for his. And she's like, no, I do love him. I will trade my soul for his. It makes it so much more powerful in a way that I didn't even know you could do until the revival, you know?
Absolutely. I think I totally agree with everything pretty much. I think for me, one of the things is it becomes less of a... So if you take someone like Papa Gay...
Mm-hmm.
See, I'm going to refer to her as she because in my head it's, you know, it's Merle.
Right.
To me, you know, she's always referred to as the antagonist. She's always referred to as the baddie.
Yeah.
I never really feel like that.
No.
I always feel like she has a very balanced point of view.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the moral they want. And Papa Gay was gentle when she, you know, led her to her rest.
Yeah.
Papa Gay... maybe we'll talk about this later with grander themes, but like I think there is a direct comparison to how the Greek gods live in that culture. That like as I put my foot in my mouth last time about Hades, but like Hades isn't a bad guy.
No,
right? Neither is Papa.
Not at all. And I think that's it. If it was a man, you know, I mean, the music is very dark and stirring,
right?
And it would feel like. He is the baddie.
Yeah.
He's trying to stop their love. But for this, it's almost like she's trying to give Timon a choice.
Yeah.
And kind of help Timon realize, what she really needs, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. I find it quite tricky.
Well, and one of the things I enjoy about it, and we're doing it right now. And I think it's important to acknowledge in its full capacity. But like, we're talking about traditional gender roles and gender stereotypes, right?
Yeah.
Now, and referring to them and capitalizing them and using them as storytelling devices, right?
Yeah.
We like this position as this role as a girl better than as a guy. And we're making assumptions about even what that means, right? And I would say if you asked us out of context... in our, you know, hashtag woke state that maybe we are or aren't in, we wouldn't, you know, we'd be much more reticent to dive into traditional gender roles. But I think it is interesting to see traditional gender roles and gender stereotypes capitalized on as a storytelling device in a contemporary, you know, liberal accepting kind of way, like in this show.
Yeah.
Because right alongside all of this, Alex Newell is playing Asaka just as full-on woman, right?
Yeah.
And all of that together somehow in my brain makes it more okay to fall into some of the traditional gender role storytelling devices that happen with Papa Gay and Timon and Daniel.
Yeah.
Where I might feel less okay with it without Alex Newell around, you know?
Alex Newell, yeah. There is, so the article that I mentioned before kind of slates it and slates the story. And it kind of says that you're going along with Timon for this whole ride and then she dies. Daniel doesn't really get his comeuppance.
Yeah.
And then it's all about, you know, she's gone and that's fine. You have to kind of pass it on. And they're trying to argue that the idea of, like, you know, pass on this story isn't enough to make up for the fact that you've just killed your protagonist who doesn't really get what she wants.
Yeah.
And, like, I can kind of see what it's talking about. But to me, I don't know, to me it just goes a lot deeper than that.
Mm.
I always kind of feel from the start that there's a lot more to it than just she falls in love and she lives happily ever after. It felt like, you know, it kind of never felt like it was going that way.
Right.
It always felt that there was something more. It's right there at the start.
Yeah.
Where, you know, she has this kind of struggle of, well, why did you save me?
Yeah.
Why me?
Yeah.
And that's a big question that I think a lot of people ask.
Yeah.
Is, you know, why me? And then the way it ends is you kind of find out roughly why.
Why? Because of all this. Yeah. I do wonder, because there's some line, and I'm going to misquote it, but like when they're, you know, at the beginning, like, and proved that love could conquer over death, basically, when they're starting. I wonder if it is worth it to end game this show just a little more, right? Because mm-hmm. they don't say, and then she dies and doesn't get what she wants.
Yeah.
And like, not that they need to say that so overtly, but it I don't know. I don't know if this is the right answer, but I would love to workshop the show once, like mm-hmm. telegraphing a little more that Timon isn't going to get Daniel.
Yeah.
You know?
But it's like, I never really, at any point, do I feel like she should get Daniel. Like, Daniel isn't a great guy. This is where I'm going to bring up Miss Saigon.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there's weird parallels. Even, you know, they came out at the exact same time. Lea Salonga is in it now. Too many parallels. Spoil the broth.
Yeah.
Like, it feels very similar in terms of story. You've got this... he's not a white savior.
Right.
But mixed race savior.
Right.
Coming in.
More privileged savior, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Kind of coming in, mm-hmm. but then has this other woman on the side,
right,
who is the other woman that ends up having to tell Timon about it,
right?
It's the plot of Miss Saigon, in many ways, but in
Miss Saigon, Miss Saigon won the Tony, and Miss Saigon lost. Will Rogers' Follies won, but still.
Exactly, and Will Rogers' Follies, a very similar narrative to this as well, but no. The idea being that for a lot of people, not me, a lot of people, Chris is the hero. Mm-hmm. And you do kind of like, oh, what a wonderful man. And he kind of saves the day at the end and he's going to take off. To me, I don't care if Chris is there or not. For me, it's just all about Kim.
Right.
In the same way with this, I don't care about Daniel one jot.
Yeah.
For me, it's all about Timon.
But Timon does care about Daniel, right?
Exactly. So this is where I think it's a little bit tricky. And I think, I mean, you know, they're not going to rewrite anything at this stage. Right. That was vain. But I feel like I would like more of a discussion with, what's her name? Sorry, I've got them all here. Erzuli. Mm-hmm. And Papagay and Timon having a kind of sit down chat together, being like, so what do you really want? You know, right. what do you mean
why,
by that?
Why are you pursuing this man?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This one in particular kind of thing. Because for me, I don't know, I always like to think that Timon falls in love with Daniel so easily mm-hmm. because she feels that this is a message from the gods. You know what I mean? Right. It's something that's just happened. He's just kind of shown up and it's like, oh, well, I've saved him. This can be the one.
Yeah.
And if you are searching your whole life for why am I here?
Right.
You look for signs like that and you kind of run with them.
Right.
And I just feel like it might be nice at some point.
Yeah.
If she's like, well, maybe this isn't what I want.
Yeah. Well, you know? So this is a question I have, though, because it is interesting to see Timon misreads her purpose, right?
Yeah.
The gods, first of all, you know, plucked from the waters by Asaka and sheltered in a tree by Azuli. The gods didn't save her in that moment so that eventually she could be this parable, at least as far as the main story goes.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead, they just save her for no reason. And then she has her I Want song, I Want a Stranger in White, and the gods heard her prayer, and they laugh about it. They're like, what a ridiculous thing. And then it becomes a challenge among the gods to decide whether love can conquer death. And they set her up, and she says, oh, gods, I understand. You saved me, so I can save him. No, they didn't. They saved her because you're their plaything, because they're using you to settle a score. And so it is interesting to see, you know, that this is why I make the Greek reference. There's something mm-hmm. very Greek about that, which to me, the fact that these two parables, you know, presumably I don't think this is entirely a Haitian parable at its core. It certainly has tenets of Haitian culture in it. But the fact that these ideals and these tropes develop divergently makes them, it's divergent evolution. Let's talk about a biology term.
Beautiful.
Right?
Well
done. Or wait, convergent evolution? That's the right thing. What's the one where the two things turn into the one thing, even though convergent evolution?
Yeah, convergent. Yeah.
Yeah. Where it's like convergent evolution in storytelling. where both of these tropes, both of these storytelling devices, both of these concepts developed very separately, which I find fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, no, definitely. I think though at the heart of it, what the revival portrays, I don't know if it's in the core text. I can't really decide that or not.
Yeah.
But this production, definitely with Michael Arden, what he's done is created this beautiful feminist story.
Yeah. Absolutely. Not,
which is great.
Not to mention, and we have a revival section where maybe we'll talk more about it, although this might be a 5-hour podcast at that point.
It's looking like it.
But about just like recasting it fully with Haitian culture in mind and some contemporary Haitian ideals. This revival, I have a couple friends who went to see this thing.
Same.
And they called it one of the most moving pieces of theater they've ever experienced.
Yep. So well done, Michael Arden. Smart little nugget, you.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
Right, we're almost out of the woods of the themes. It's the most thematic show that's ever existed.
Listeners, Jimmy was worried we weren't going to have enough to talk about.
I know. My goodness. Also, I don't think I've said it. I'm extremely sleep deprived.
Yeah, well, it's like 4 a.m. in Scotland right now, right?
It may as well be.
When does the sun, because you guys are in the Arctic Circle, so doesn't, are you in like the 12 months where you get like 24 hours of sun or 24 hours of not sun?
So
right now
your geography knowledge is disgusting. No, like we'll get, the sun will start coming up around 4
a.m
yes,
that's ridiculous. That is ridiculous.
And then it'll go down around like 11, 10, 10, 11.
What does it look like in the winter then?
Dark. It's quite dark.
That's insanity.
Wait,
I think,
what do you have? You're north.
No, no. Sunrise, sunset.
I always make this.
Sunrise, sunset, maybe sunset moves by an hour and a half, 2 hours over the course of a year.
Hmm.
Sunrise is...
Oh, no, it's very, very different for us.
That's insanity. Like, yeah. I knew that was a thing because I joked about it at the beginning, but I don't think I quite conceptualized how that would impact a person's life.
Yeah. So it's quite funny because if you're ever out late... So see, for example, at the Fringe.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see so much daylight. It's wonderful because you often go home while the sun is either rising or has fully risen because you've been up so late.
That's great. You all, the window covering industry must be booming in Scotland.
I know. Everyone has to have curtains.
Yeah?
Because we just can't cope.
Yeah.
We just can't cope. Anyway, it's dark right now. So there we go. And I'm tired. That's all we need to know. And if I don't make any sense, it's because of that. Anyway.
So as a nice before you fall asleep topic to talk about, nice and uplifting, what do you say we talk about religion and death?
I think we definitely should. And you say uplifting, I have things to say about that. Anyway, yeah, before we kind of leave the... Obviously, we started to touch upon the gods and how they fit into this tale. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the things that I've noticed, I wonder what you think about this,
yeah,
is the weird kind of mirror with the Bible.
Okay, what do you mean?
So... in the sense that, obviously, in Uti, mm-hmm, it's, you know, like we've just said, the gods are playing around and they kind of have their own score to settle.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt that Timun does kind of end up as a sacrifice, for the greater good.
Interesting. And right? That she does become a parable.
Right.
Yeah.
Obviously, in the Bible,
yeah,
there's a quite big prominent character called Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I've heard. I'm acquainted.
Yeah, who dies?
Yeah,
on a mission from God.
Yeah,
in order to, kind of save the people.
My sticking point is the difference between literally the Western monotheistic God and all polytheistic God beliefs. Because I think one of the big differences is that when you have one God, he is good and all knowing, and everything he does is perfect. And when you have many gods, they become fallible. And Jesus is predominantly infallible and knows that he is the savior.
Yeah.
I do see connections in like Jesus's uncertainty of his purpose and Timun's uncertainty of his purpose, of her purpose. I think I find Timun's more exhilarating than Jesus's. We've talked about this in Superstar, but I think Jesus's story is boring. I find this interesting because she doesn't know, because she gets it wrong, because she's fallible. Whereas Jesus is much less so.
Yeah. No, I'm not trying to say that this Uti is actually a parabolic figure of the Bible.
But it's interesting to think about.
But it's just the interesting parallels there, because they are very religious texts.
Oh, absolutely.
I think there is definitely these two characters that kind of follow a similar path.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's not that similar, but in terms of the kind of higher order
but they,
of things.
They go on a journey. It is interesting. Ah, man, have you read the Da Vinci Code?
I have.
Great.
Of course.
I think there's a bunch of really awful literature and plays that like conceptualize Jesus as being in love with, there's a bunch of great ones that conceptualize him as being gay, which I find fascinating. But like part of the Da Vinci Code conceit is that, you know, Jesus is not this celibate paragon of masculinity, but is in fact a lover just like every other human in the world. And it is the sort of thing, I don't know, this is just coming to me right now, so who knows how well thought out this is. But I think, you know, I was raised Catholic, and then being gay makes that less of a compatible thing, as I think we've talked before. But maybe one of the problems I have with Catholicism is the concept of unconditional love for God, as opposed to unconditional love, full stop.
Yeah.
For humanity, for the other, that you are like capable of that, which I think the story of Once on This Island portrays more fully in a way that I could get on board with more, you know, feminist discussion aside, but the idea that the concept of love can conquer the concept of death, that Timun can be unconditionally in love with another being, regardless of how awful that being is and how betrothed that being is. Like, that gives me a wonderfully optimistic, wholesome portrayal of humanity.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, let's talk about Jesus's motivations. either unconditional love for God or unconditional love for humanity, both of which seem terribly selfish. And I don't think any love is selfish. Like, the whole, like, love is the opposite of selfish, right? You give yourself to whatever. So unconditional love for God is like, I give all my love to you, imaginary bearded man in the sky. Or like unconditional love for humanity, for a humanity that clearly doesn't love you back because, you know, they put you on that dang cross. I don't know. Seems selfish. I don't know. You burst a balloon in my mind in an interesting way, and now I'm watching the confetti fall.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I like to do. And then I'll leave and leave you in an existential crisis. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, it's not a huge point. It's just something that I'd kind of was like, oh, this is a weird familiarity.
It's interesting to think about, I think, especially in the context that, like, this is a... It is a westernized or western-friendly tale of, like, things that are decidedly non-western in a bunch of ways.
Yeah.
And so it's a secret way in to some of those themes and some of those ideals.
Totally.
You know, that is exciting to me. That is interesting to me.
Yeah. And I do want to talk about death. So it's funny you laugh. So this is something that I, as I'm aging and I'm reading more and I'm becoming a big old intellectual.
Yes.
I find very fascinating is kind of how different cultures and different people kind of have a relationship with death.
Yeah.
And I mean death as in dying, not the person.
Right. Not Papa Gay.
Or
Hades or whoever your death symbolism is.
Yeah. Or death from the Terry Pratchett novels. Do you, Terry Pratchett, talk to me about Terry Pratchett. Do you get him over there?
We get him over here. Have I read him? No.
Oh, you should. Yeah. Don't start. Don't do them in order. It never works.
Okay.
It's your main thing. The best books are the death books. Anyway, now, I'm not some big old death fiend. You know, I mean, I don't...
Probably for the best.
My golf days are behind me. But there's something very interesting about it.
Yeah.
Now, why am I bringing it up with Once It's Silent? Mm-hmm. So it all comes down to, again, this production, with The Circle and the Square.
Yeah.
One of the key features of it is that all the cast are on stage at all times, all taking part in the action.
Yeah.
Death is always present.
Yeah.
Death is always present. Now, in Haitian culture, the Loa, the gods, the kind of like in-between gods that our characters are in this show, they revere death.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They really, really do. It's not something that everyone should be afraid of. It's not the worst thing that can happen. Mm-hmm. It's something that can be embraced something that, you know, you're not necessarily looking forward to, but there's so much hope within it. So I think it's, they have this thing, I really apologize if I'm bastardizing this, but I think it's like, when you die, your soul goes into the water or anywhere. I think it's anywhere that has an echo, which I love.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, for a year and a day.
Okay.
And then after that, your soul gets released and it can become part of the world again.
Yeah.
And so they have this like year and a day celebration after you've died for that length of time, and it is a joyous thing of like, they're coming back into the world again. And I just think that's so beautiful. You know, over in the West, we have this very strange relationship with death. It's very, very odd.
We're
constantly terrified. It really is the kind of worst thing that can ever happen. And it's something that from a very, very young age is kind of drilled into you as, it's a dark old thing. And, you know, we obviously have the concept of heaven and hell. I'm not even Catholic, and yet that has formed the entirety of my life.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I still think about, oh, I shouldn't do that because of hell. This thing that I don't even believe in.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know, it's something, and I like the fact that as I'm getting older, I'm kind of reading more and understanding that there are other ways to think about it. And it is something that you can kind of embrace a bit more.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest pieces of literature that have shown me that is the His Dark Materials trilogy.
Okay.
Have you read them?
No.
Oh, we can't actually be friends anymore. The podcast is over. You need to read them. So without a shadow of a doubt, His Dark Materials is the best piece of fiction I've ever read.
Really?
Ever.
Okay.
Nothing will ever top it. I read it every day.
Yeah.
I have been doing so over the past probably 7 years.
Yeah.
Before that, the first time I read it, I was 12 years old. Yeah. It's just a part of my life now.
Yeah.
And to me, it feels biblical. It is a kind of thing that I go to when I need to, I have questions.
Yeah.
And I know that's so silly because it's a piece of fiction. It doesn't matter.
We all do that.
Exactly.
So is
we all have our things.
So is the Bible.
Absolutely. So His Dark Materials has many themes, a myriad of themes.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of mostly known for its conflict with religion.
Okay.
And how it discusses religion.
Yeah.
Like the film The Golden Compass.
Okay.
Did you see that?
I did, on a snow day in college. I made hilarious jokes.
Lucky you. So, one of the reasons why they didn't make any more
was because the first one was really bad.
But also because the church were like,
You
can't.
Right.
So they just had to like rinse it of all of the meaning of the whole story.
Right.
It's not anti-religion. It's not anti-church. It's not anti-Catholic. It's not anti-religion. Mm-hmm. It's just a discussion. It gives you both sides in equal measures. Perfect. Anyway, the way it talks about death is the thing that's interesting. In the third book, the two main characters travel into the world of the dead, which is a kind of abstract cross-section of everyone's concept of what the world of the dead is.
Yeah.
It's a place where dead people go.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's what it is.
Yeah.
And so they go there. One of the kind of key features of the stories as well is in Lyra's world, which is very similar to ours but with slight differences, each person has their demon, which is a reflection of yourself, whether it means it's your personality, whether it's your soul, it's just something that is an extension of you and that you carry with you for your entire life. It's just a part of you.
Yeah.
When they go into the world of the dead, they realize that there's another part of them that they haven't seen because it's not a part of their world. And that is your death. And you carry your death with you your entire life. The people that they meet in the world of the dead talk about it, and they basically say that, no, he's there, but just because it's not a part of your culture, your death has been hiding from you.
Yeah.
And they teach them how to meet their death and how to talk to their death. And, you know, Lyra and Will, the other main character, being Western children, have this instant fear, this instant recoil from, oh my gosh, but you're my death. This is horrible.
Yeah.
But when they speak to the other families, who are well acquainted with their deaths, they're either just there, it's just something that's like, oh yeah, cool, or there's an older woman there and she's extremely close to the death and her death is extremely close with her, and they're kind of thick as thieves, as she embraces it and is just so relaxed about the fact that she's getting old and that she's dying, because she has her death there with her to keep her company and take her through that. And to me, it's just like one of the most beautiful thoughts and most beautiful portrayals of death that I've kind of ever encountered. It's just fantastic.
Yeah.
And it really just made me think about like, oh yeah, the only reason I think it's scary is
because
I've been told.
You've been told to. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. I find it fascinating, humans' discussion of death based on different cultures and how we contextualize it and, you know, like, depending upon your outlook, either, like, justify it or calm ourselves in our mind or get really worked up about it and scared about it. Have you ever, we're you know, two tracks south of the show right now, the brain train has left.
I've got a way back. Okay. It's all right.
But have you ever heard of the fable of the dragon tyrant?
The dragon tyrant? No, I have not.
If this part makes it into the podcast, there's a great animated version of it by a YouTuber called CGP Grey. It's based on a philosophical article written by like a contemporary philosopher in a medical journal. I think it's the Journal of Medical Ethics or something. But the idea is, once upon a time, there was an ancient kingdom where on top of a hill lived the dragon tyrant. And the dragon tyrant, this huge dragon, demanded a sacrifice. Every day, 1% of the population must be delivered to the dragon's teeth. Else the dragon will wreak destruction upon the land. You know, heroes attempted to slaughter the dragon tyrant to no avail. There's nothing they can do. So finally, the society decided, all right, we will just deliver every day. 1% of the population will be delivered to the dragon tyrant. You never know who it's going to be. And, you know, we're going to deliver them to the dragon tyrant. And eventually, economies developed around this. You know, they built a train line that went to the dragon tyrant's mouth. There are people employed to be like dragon tyrant counselors who would go to your house and like, yes, your loved one, you know, they're on their way to the dragon tyrant and we will accommodate for you. And, you know, there's a pension that has been given to you to help you accommodate in this difficult time. And, you know, the population still didn't dwindle. Like, it's only 1%. People thrived and it just became a part of life and became a part of society. And people taught that, like, you know, our purpose is, because our life is so short, we must make the most of it and do what we can before we too will be delivered to the dragon tyrant on this train to this station. And then one day, some budgeting scientist, you know, technology has developed and we may have discovered a material that can kill the dragon. We're not quite sure if it's going to work. It's going to take decades of research. It may entirely fail, but we think we may have figured this out. And there's a whole bunch of societal implications about like, well, but the purpose is to be delivered to the dragon tyrant. And, you know, this is the natural order of things. How must we? But then all sorts of society, don't do the story any justice, but they develop a missile made of this brand new material. And the king is there at the countdown for the missile that may or may not kill the dragon tyrant. And one of his assistant runs up and goes, wait, my wife is on the last train to the dragon tyrant. We must fire it now. And the king is like, we can't. We must wait till the prescribed time. And I'm so sorry. If only we had started research a second earlier, a day earlier, your wife might be saved. And then they launch the missile and it kills the dragon and totally upends society because now we must no longer. And it is an interesting philosophical discussion of like death as an inevitability or death as an option. I find all of the discussion fascinating.
Absolutely. I've thought about that a few times because it's weird when you're young. I think when you're really young, the immortality thing is all you want.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? You just think, well, of course, who wouldn't want that?
Yeah.
And then as you get older, you're like, I can't wait sometime.
Well, do you know what I mean? there is contemporary research that the person who will live past 200 years might be born today.
Wow.
Based on medical science and medical technology. Maybe. Yeah. And like, so, it raises all sorts of interesting ethical questions. Oh, totally. And yeah,
environmental questions, but like, I don't know, to me at the moment that is scarier to me than the prospect of dying at the age of 75 or 80. Like, I can't think of anything worse.
But
you know,
the potential of death as not an inevitability, which I think maybe if we're gonna slowly yank it back is core to a lot of death mythology that exists in the world, is that your death is not a permanent, you exist either in heaven or as a story or as reincarnation. Like, mm-hmm. your existence continues beyond your own, you know, mm-hmm. human self.
Yeah.
Is like a deeply rooted core human desire that we use religion and a billion other things to like justify and, you know, make ourselves feel optimistic about.
Mm-hmm.
And Once on This Island is one of those,
yeah,
one of those justifications, one of those like feel good stories about it, hopeful possibilities about it.
It definitely is. It's kind of always, it's always there. I think that's the thing is, you know, she's aware and all of the islanders are aware that it's just, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's a nice, it's a weirdly comforting thought.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You're not trying to hide from it.
Yeah.
You're just accepting it.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
And that was some rave comforting.
I am a tree holding away the storm. Here in my arms, I'll keep you safe and warm. Even the gods won't dare cross this line where my life is forever yours, and you are mine. We'll race away. Storm will turn to sun on an island where the earth and sea are one. Sure as this night leads to a sky of blue, sure as my heart led me to be with you, the gods meant this to be a sign that my life is forever yours, and you are mine.
Mine. Arrogant fool, think you can hold back death.
Stay away.
This boy is mine. I am his dying. Sure is a grave, you must accept what is. Now his life is forevermore.
Take mine for his.
I do think, and perhaps as a moment of transition, this is a moment to talk about both my favorite and my least favorite line in all of musical theater. It's two words. Do you know what it is, Jimmy?
It's
when
do.
The whole company goes, A tree!
Yeah.
I think this is the most difficult line to deliver in all of musical theater. Full stop.
I know. It's. Oh, I think, so, right, we're talking about the revival now.
Yeah.
I'm saying that because they've had a transition.
I think I think the revival, from what I've heard and what I've seen, does it right where no one else has.
No, because it's so difficult.
It's so difficult.
Come on, Aaron Flaherty.
I'm not even gonna say difficult. It's so stupid.
Do you mean the concept of her becoming a tree?
I think,
or just the way it's delivered?
I think the concept is beautiful.
Okay, good.
And I think the concept is heavy and fraught with imagery and hope and foreshadowing. Mm. And I think the delivery, or at least the scripting, is so inconsiderate of how heavy and important that moment must be.
Yep.
Because you've from the moment Mama Urale starts singing, "Oh, Team Moon." Like, you are crying. You are bawling. This is the most intensely emotional experience you've had all night. Like, I listen to the cast recording and it still brings tears to my eyes.
Yeah.
It is
so
moving, and it is a beautiful progression of, like, and, you know, she gave herself up and they went to the walls and they threw out the coins and the gods were gentle and they led her into the ocean where she gently died. And, oh, we've been building to this moment where she sacrificed herself. And the gods transformed her into a tree! Like, what the fuck?
But, right, okay, in defense of the revival...
No defense needed, but...
Well, what I mean is, I think at this point... So do you know what they do at this point in the show?
Yes.
Right. It makes... It's grand enough that it equates to what's happening with the line.
It's not just that it's grand enough. Do you think a spoiler alert is worthy? Do you think it's... Okay.
I mean, spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. If you're going to go see Once on This Island, hit skip forward a whole bunch of it. But there's basically a downed telephone pole that's been sitting on stage the entire show. And it lifts up with Timon on top of it. Basically, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it's because it's almost like a Chekhov's gun moment.
Right. It's been there the whole show.
The whole time.
Yeah.
And then it's it's the tree and cool.
And it's her, I feel like that's quite exciting. And she's in it and she just died on top of it and then she comes to
life. And she looks great. Her costume at the end is amazing.
And then she's up in the air as they sing around her.
Yeah. It's fabulous. So I don't mind it in the revival.
Right.
Anywhere else?
No.
I've
been to shows where that's a laugh line.
Exactly. And it's such a shame that it is.
Because it kills the momentum. I've told you about my most tragic high school experience on stage ever. It's as Jack in the tree and, like, you know, the steward killed my mother. Well, I'm going to kill her. Like, I want to deliver it with that emotional intensity that every high schooler wants, but instead it's a laugh line.
Yeah.
It's murderous. I hate that shit.
Yeah, I know. It's such a shame. Yeah. Especially for an actor.
Yeah.
But
they figured it out in the revival.
I think they
finally
did.
Finally.
Well, where we're on the topic, let's just talk a bit about the set design. Here. Fantastic.
it literally makes me viscerally happy, like deep down on my inside.
Like, it's genius. Dane Laffery is the set designer for this. I don't know what else he's done. What else has he done, T? Do you know?
I don't know offhand.
Let's find out, shall we? Oh, okay. So he did Michael Arden's Spring Awakening as well.
That makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. He's done loads. Good on you, pal.
As a lot of set designers have done.
Yeah, exactly. So really, really smart. And I think in many levels, this is like kind of... If you are a set designer, it's a good moment to geek out.
Oh, yeah.
Because basically, there is a huge storm that takes place on the island. That's where the story begins. Mm-hmm. But they saved Timon. They put her in the tree. So the whole setting is kind of a wreck.
Yeah.
And there's... real water on stage, there's real fire, there's sand, there are boxes. At one point, they start cooking.
Yeah.
It's just so beautifully functional of this idea of kind of plowing on through.
Yeah. Well, and the entire production design is informed by this. Like, even everyone's costume is either made of, like, what looks like secondhand or lost clothes, or in the case of the gods, like, manufactured really from trash, actual trash, but intentionally so. Like, all of Urzuli's costume is like medical detritus. She's got like a stethoscope belt, and it's all sorts of like IV tubes that make up her crown. It is so deliciously intentional in a way that makes the story so much more authentic.
I
don't know if you've seen any of the clips of like the Tony Award performances of the 1990 production.
Yeah.
It kind of looks like, and pardon me, but it looks like a white person was like, aha, Islanders, I shall travel to Party City. Do you know what Party City is? Do they have
Yes,
those?
I do.
Shall travel to Party City and go to the tropical themed party section and purchase all of the items there. Because clearly that is what the show should look like.
Yeah.
And it is disgustingly insensitive.
Yeah, exactly. There's no authenticity there.
No.
But I think it's just smart. And like, it kind of comes as this idea of death.
Yeah.
Right from the start, it's full of destruction.
Yeah.
It should be something people should be mourning.
Right.
Because so much has gone wrong.
Yeah.
But instead, it's all about getting by and making do and telling a beautiful story.
Instead, it's all of these adults being like, this child is sad. We must tell her a story to tell her that it's all going to be okay.
Yeah.
Once on this island, here is the story. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
it's so beautiful. I just think it's just really, really smart.
Yeah.
And especially kind of in this day and age of natural disasters, you know, we've seen a lot of it firsthand. Just something like Katrina.
Yeah.
It's devastating.
Yeah.
But a big part of it is, you know, we look to, well, how do we get back?
Right, the resilience of humanity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that isn't really in the story.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
But it is done so well that it feels like it should be, you know?
It just feels like it is.
Like there's
to me,
like there should be no other way to do this show now.
Exactly. Exactly. Like it feels like that's what it is about, is coming back together and how we get on through.
Absolutely.
It's so beautifully weaved into all the themes. Really, really great. The other thing as well is the instrumentation.
Mm-hmm.
Orchestrator's name is Anne-Marie Melazzo. Sorry if I've said that wrong. But she's the orchestrator and is used, you know, all this different kind of rubbish and trash as instruments. The first thing you hear in the cash recording is so cool. Are these empty rubber pipes that get swung around really vigorously and create this kind of haunting, chilling wind sound almost.
Yeah.
And right from the start, you're like, this is cool.
Yeah.
Because it gives you, I don't know, it gives you a strange Islander vibe, I guess.
Yeah. Well,
but also a bit of the surreal and... It launches you right in there.
I think this is a thing I think I will struggle the rest of my life to articulate and falls into the hashtag this season sucks. But the production design for this show is so thoughtful and intentional. Nothing was done just because. Nothing was done just because it looks cool. Nothing was done just because we can. Everything is so deeply rooted in the storytelling. And I miss that in my musical theater.
Exactly. Like, yeah, man.
Because it makes it so much more important and moving. Because then I trust you, right? Even as Joe audience member, not as me. But like, if I can pick out one thing that I see that you've done intentionally because it relates to the story, I trust that you're thoughtfully trying to tell me something.
Absolutely.
That you've put some time and effort and thought into this. And I'm a broken goddamn record, but like so many shows nowadays don't do that. And it doesn't instill that trust.
No.
And then why bother?
Exact thing is, I just feel like set designers are gifted people. Like they do some amazing things. And when you get set designs that work.
Yeah.
And by that, I don't mean, you know, the tracks work really, really well.
But that are
like when
effective.
You've got, yeah, when they just make sense.
Yeah.
When it is ingrained in, when the set design tells as much of a story as your book.
Yeah.
That's when it's perfect. Like that's when it's great. And I really do feel that Once on This Island is nailing that this season.
Oh, absolutely. I think.
Absolutely nailing it.
This speaks to, I wonder if it is endemic of my philosophy or if my philosophy is derived from this, being a tech theater teacher. But I grow prickly and angsty and difficult to work with when I meet, mm-hmm. and it happens all the time in educational theater, but when I mm-hmm. meet educational directors who talk about reusing set pieces, mm-hmm. and I understand it's a practicality. And I mm-hmm. certainly work in a world where I build modular platforms and flats and things that can be reused and repainted. But yeah. I never want an audience to know that this set uses a bunch of pieces of that set.
Yeah,
I
totally.
Never want this piece to look like that piece repainted. Oh, I remember that door from this previous show. Oh, you know, oh, remember that dress from Hello Dolly? Now they're using it in My Fair Lady.
Yeah.
I hate that. It drives me bonkers, because if it was appropriate for the one show, it should be entirely inappropriate for this show.
Yeah.
And
totally.
It happens all the time. Drives me bonkers. It happens on yeah. Broadway right now. Not that they're reusing set props, but, you know, there are plenty of
they're
sets.
They're just doing the same thing.
Yeah. You could.
They're just like, oh, that worked really well for that.
Exactly. Like, you know what? You could probably perform all of Escape to Margaritaville on the SpongeBob SquarePants set.
So true.
Right?
It's so, so true.
That's awful.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a shame. And so I do feel like I'm just... We haven't really talked much about the Tonys other than just to slate it. But
yeah, I think we're avoiding it.
I know. The revival category will be interesting.
Yeah, it's the only thing I'm hopeful and interested about.
Yeah, I totally am. And I think because there's only three of them,
yeah.
I am just very like, ooh, it's a close race. It's yeah. a very close race.
Yeah.
And I really hope that Once in the Island doesn't get forgotten about.
Yeah.
I don't think it will, but I can't tell.
It's so hard to predict nowadays. I mean, I'm gearing up to make video. Really, gearing up's the wrong word. I'm like...
girding your loins.
That's great. I'm girding my loins for the videos I am, like, you know, mentally, contractually obligated to put out this season. There's just nothing to talk about.
I know.
But what? My Fair Lady, Once on This Island, and Carousel?
Carousel, yeah.
If it's not Once on This Island, I'm going to have some very serious all cap words on Twitter.
Yeah.
Mark my words, America.
I know.
And the United States and the rest of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. Hey, when yeah. does justice ever happen?
No,
it does sometimes. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
But there's no point for justice. It's the only one. Like, even in Best Musical, The Band's Visit has already gotten its due, and I don't think it's going to win Best
That's
Musical.
The thing. But. Critics are like, yeah, well, no, I feel like they just feel like they can't legitimately say that it's going to be SpongeBob.
Right, but it's probably going to be SpongeBob. And I am like fortifying my brain for all the I told you so comments I'm going to get on like a series of videos. And to
I'm
be like,
to...
I still don't like it.
I know. That's the thing is I'm trying to force myself to like it.
Yeah.
But I think it goes beyond... just, you know, enjoying the cast recording.
Yeah.
I think it's what it stands for. And no. I know that's awful.
No, that's, but it's not even forcing yourself to like it. I'm trying to force myself to listen to it.
Yeah.
It's not,
I really like the David Bowie song.
No. I'm going to say it to the hills. It's not good. It's not good.
Yeah.
It's not good, even disregarding because of what it is.
Yeah.
It's just not
I like good. The David Bowie song is musically interesting. That's it. I just think it's just I've never been a SpongeBob fan. I don't really care. I don't really understand the characters.
I am a mild SpongeBob fan, and I don't.
Yeah.
It really. I am sad and disappointed about the world.
I know.
Please, God, Once on This Island, win Best Revival, so I have something
exactly.
to look forward to.
It would just be really good,
Tony's.
And I just feel like. The cast love it, so I know all the cast love their shows, but for the cast, I think the cast really love this.
Yeah.
Talking, and what I must say, though, is I don't think there are too many snubs this season, but I'm really disappointed that Alex Newell didn't get nominated for Best Supporting.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
He deserved it.
I think he really does. I've been following Alex Newell since the Glee project,
because
we all know that I'm an out-and-out Gleek. The second he... was on my screen watching that show, I was like, this person is electrifying, and I've never seen anyone like that before. This is amazing. Gave me confidence. I'm like, you're like 20 years younger than me. I know that's not true, but you know, a lot younger. And like, you're wanting me to be a better person.
Yeah.
Then he went on Glee, and changed everything for the better. It was incredible. And now he's on Broadway and I'm just like, this is so great. And I just think he's so talented.
Yeah.
I think he's incredibly talented. I think he's an incredible mover. I think he's an incredible actor. And of course, the pipes don't even need questioning.
God, absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It takes a lot. To portray that character on TV when there was never a character like that before.
Yeah.
There was never a high school trans student who is living out and proud.
Yeah.
Ever.
No. Like, just the
never happened.
The confidence alone, but then to just like even go through with the role.
But exactly.
Then to like embrace it and portray it as fully and thoughtfully and
the confidence was just unshakable. It was incredible. And I really hope that it helped a lot of trans kids out there.
I'm sure.
Because me not even being a trans kid, it helped me.
Yeah.
Like, it was incredible.
Yeah.
And I just think he deserves lots of plaudits.
Yeah, because he does it so well. And, like, it's so legitimizing because it's not... Like, that's why the gender portrayal in this is so great, because it's not a big deal, which makes it such a big
deal.
Nobody
cares.
Right.
I'm sure bloody half the audiences don't even realize.
No, I'm sure there are all sorts of tourists from Oklahoma who are like, wow, she was great.
She was great.
Who is she? And then they Google her on her way home. They're like, what?
Oh, my God. I know. I forever will love Alex Newell.
Yeah.
And I hope this is a great start of a Broadway career. I don't know.
I would die in that like millennial I love this kind of way.
Totally. And I just want to see more.
Yeah.
Give me more.
Yeah.
That was a snub for me, but that's okay.
That's all right. You've got a Tony in our hearts, Alex Newell.
Absolutely.
The only one that matters. Because apparently none of the other ones matter anymore.
Jim and Tomic Tony.
Oh man, I don't even know. You know, like, picture the archetype that Frank Sinatra paints himself as while he sings My Way drunk at a bar in, like, the heyday of the Rat Pack.
Yeah.
Just, like, so utterly smashed that there's nothing positive about the world, but you're like, but things are fine. That's going to be me at the end of the Tony Awards.
Excellent.
Get excited.
I wonder how they'll finale it.
Because
who is it? Sarah Bareilles and Josh Groban.
They're just going to cut to like Stephen Sondheim at home, angry. Throwing popcorn at the TV.
Yeah. Maybe this will be the first year they don't declare a winner.
God.
Because that happened. Did you see that?
Don't get my hopes up, Jimmy.
Don't get my hopes up. Was it Critics' Choice? What was the awards that were like, there's no winner this year?
The Pulitzers no do that sometimes.
And no, it wasn't. I say the article. I can't remember what it was. I'll try and find it. But there was an article, and it was saying that there was this award that didn't offer any awards this year to any shows. And I'm like, well, that says it all.
Don't tease me like that. It's gonna be SpongeBob, and I'm gonna throw things.
I mean, it will. It's all good.
Anyway. The revival's great.
It will hopefully also be Once on the Sailor.
Yes. Because otherwise,
yay!
I have nothing to live for. No.
No, that's not true. We tell the story. But yeah, what a show.
We tell the story.
Life is wild.
We tell the story.
Pain is wild.
We tell the story.
Love is wild.
We tell the story.
Grief is wild.
We tell the story.
Love is wild.
We tell the story.
Faith is wild.
We tell the story.
We tell the story.
and the wealthy is the Grand Ole. And on this island, We tell the story.
That was once on this island.
That was once, twice, three times on this island. There's that one lyric. Someone to live for, and I just want them to replace the lyric live with the word three. Someone, two, three, four. Right?
That's true. Yeah.
I don't know if it would improve the show, but it would make me feel better.
Maybe, yeah, just get in touch with Lynn.
Yeah.
And she'll no doubt.
Hey, Lynn. Cute fist under my chin, leaning sideways, blinking my eyeballs.
Aww. Nickels, nickels, nickels. Yeah.
nickels.
Yeah.
What a... Never mind.
Charlie Brown.
No, anyway. I don't know what that means.
So,
you've got a quiz question.
I do. I do indeed. Hey, Tommy.
Hey, Jimmy.
It's another statement, but this seems to be what we're doing. Quiz statement. Did you know that the film version of this musical proved that Gene Kelly was afraid of cows?
I did know that, but only recently.
Exactly. What could that possibly be?
Oh man, if it's anything like our last one, no one will know.
I bet you everyone knows this.
Maybe,
anyway.
Man, those are always the worst when we're like, oh, we thought this was so, yeah.
Yep.
If you want to get in contact with us, I'm Musical Mash on Twitter or Musical Theater Mash on the YouTubes.
And I am Asen Hendrix on Twitter and YouTube as well. And you can get in touch with us both over at our show Twitter at Jim and Tomic.
Or you can head to jimandtomic.com, which has the Reddit discussion, the show notes, and all sorts of other fabulous things.
Yes, indeed. We also have a Patreon link there. If you feel like donating to us, that would be absolutely wonderful if you would like.
And, of course, tell your friends. And, of course, we'll see you next week.
Yes, goodbye now.
Toot de loom. I don't know, I wanted to say something different, and then I panicked.
I feel like this is going to become another, like, week-on-week thing, is Tommy saying a different thing, and now we have Toot de Loom in the world.
Oh no, what corner have I boxed myself into?
No one knows. Right, I'm going to bed.
All right, good night. Bye, everyone!
Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.